Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, streaming from AirAmericaRadio.com. And on CRN Digital, on cable TV systems in 29 states, as well as on radio stations from coast to coast. Welcome to our program. It's the first hour of our Friday program when we, as usual, for, what, a couple of years now, I believe, have on Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. A little later on in the program, David Tebow, in the next hour, is going to be with us with CNSNews.com. He's going to be telling us why abstinence only is the only kind of education that should be happening in our schools, and I'm going to be telling him he's nuts. And then in the third hour of our program, we're going to have Spencer Overton on. He's the author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. But right now, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives in the history of that body, a brilliant man, truly progressive politician, and just the man of the people from Vermont. His website, Bernie.org. Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. The estate tax, the Paris Hilton tax, looks like the Republicans are going to get half a loaf here.
Well, actually, I think it's more than half a loaf. But I think this estate tax, the repeal of the estate tax, or much of the estate tax, is a metaphor for virtually what this entire Republican administration in Congress stand for. I mean, it really is obscene, and there's no other word that I can use to describe it. Tom, if you walk down the street in any town in America, and you go up to people and you say, well, what do you think the major problem, you know, facing our country is, facing your state, facing your community is, how many people do you think will tell you that the major problem is that millionaires and billionaires are paying too much in taxes, and that we have to make significant reductions in the taxes that the smallest number of hugely wealthy people pay? How often do you think that will happen?
If I was walking down the street in a gated community where all the butler or the chauffeurs were out in front with the Mercedes or the Rolls Royces, I might encounter a few. But even frankly, Bernie, I have some friends of great wealth. I have one friend in particular whose father invented a product that everybody would immediately recognize the name of. I don't want to out my friend, but he was born with a trust fund that was close to $1 billion. And he is one of the most progressive people I know. There are a lot of very wealthy people who are very progressive.
Right. And here you have, though, the Republican leadership and the president pushing the repeal of the estate tax, which in its present form, because of increases in exemptions in recent years, right now this would benefit the upper two-tenths of 1% of our population. 99.8% of people get no benefits at all. And meanwhile, if this thing is passed in its current form, it will run up increase the national debt by about $750 billion over a 10-year period. That is, of course, on top of the $8.2 trillion national debt that we have, leaving that legacy to our children and our grandchildren. So our kids are going to be picking up a debt in order to benefit the wealthiest two-tenths of 1% of our population. And that is what these guys are all about. They talk about moral values. Well, their major value is greed. They want more and more and more. And at exactly the same time as they want billions in tax breaks for a handful of the wealthiest families in America, they want to cut back on Medicare, Medicaid, financial aid for college students, cut back on the needs of our veterans, cut back on environmental protection. There has never been, in my mind, a clearer example of what this administration and the Republican leadership stand for, and it really is an outrage.
The Paris Hilton tax, also another outrage. There was a vote in the Senate yesterday not to set a time to withdraw from Iraq. At the same time that when George W. Bush was in Iraq for his five-hour photo op stunt earlier in the week, the vice president of Iraq, if the news reports are accurate, asked him for a date certain to pull out of Iraq.
Well, what's going on there? One of the untold stories, Tom, about the war in Iraq is that what polls show is that in very overwhelming numbers, we're talking about 75%, amidst all of the chaos and instability that exists in Iraq today, the people of Iraq feel that their country would be safer, would be more secure if we withdrew our troops.
And this, by the way, is the reason why I'm kind of officially this week stopping referring to it as the war in Iraq, because the war really ended when we seized their government, and it's now the occupation of Iraq.
Well, what you have here is you have a president who misled us into Iraq, cherry-picked the intelligence, told the American people all of the reasons why he wanted us to go to war, but did not respect the other intelligence that was coming into his office that told him, wait a minute, we're not sure if Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Wait a minute, we think the intelligence that links Iraq to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda is not reliable. Wait a minute, we think those aluminum tubes that you're showing on television indicating Iraqi nuclear program is inaccurate. Wait a minute, this allegation that Iraq is getting depleted uranium from Niger is wrong. And he chose to ignore all of that intelligence. Then, once we got into the war, we all remember, you know, Mr. Bush on the ship talking about mission accomplished, completely unprepared for what to expect. And now, 3.5 years into the war, they have no approach, no plan on how to end it, on how to bring our troops home. It's more of the same, more of the failed policies. And I think the American people are catching on to that.
Yeah, as the Iraqi people apparently did some time ago.
Bernie,
earlier in the week, I did a story which I had picked up from, let's say, non-mainstream news sources. It's kind of all over the blogosphere about this NAFTA superhighway. Yesterday, Lou Dobbs picked the thing up, and apparently CNN has vetted it, and it's solid. That what came out of this meeting a year ago, March, down in Waco, Texas, with Vicente Fox and Paul Martin and George W. Bush, is a superhighway from the Pacific coast of Mexico, from Pacific coast cities in Mexico, all the way up through the United States to Canada. The first customs stop will actually be in Kansas City. That parts of it are going through Texas are going to be outsourced to a Spanish company to build a toll road, and that the benefit of this, as it's being sold to the participants, is that they will be able to offload Chinese goods without using longshoremen labor in the Mexican ports, put them into trucks that are driven by non-Teamsters Mexican truck drivers, and then they can be transported all the way to their destination in the United States without the Teamsters or the longshoremen ever getting near them. Do you know anything about this? And
no, not more than I've heard. But, you know, this is part of an effort on the part of the leadership of this country to sell out the middle class of America and the working people of this country. As you and I have discussed many, many times, NAFTA has been an absolute failure for the workers in the United States of America as well as for the lower-income people in Mexico. Tom, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Mexico, to one of the rural areas in Mexico, to their farm country. There are no longer young people on farms, at least in that area of Mexico. They've all left the farms because they can't compete with cheap American corn that's coming over the border.
Which we're subsidizing.
Right. Meanwhile, in the United States, as a result not only of NAFTA, but permanent normal trade relations with China and other trade agreements, we've lost 2.9 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. Right now, we're on the cusp of losing millions of good-paying information technology jobs. We're in a race to the bottom, and if we do not change our economic policies in this country, and trade being one of the important parts of that, for the first time in modern American history, the next generation is going to have a lower standard of living than we do, than our generation, despite huge increases in worker productivity and technology. And what's going on is all of the wealth, virtually not all, but virtually all of the wealth that is being created is going to the people onto the top, the CEOs of large corporations, while the middle class continues to shrink and poverty increases. And man, if we don't get a handle on these disastrous trade policies, the future of the middle class in the United States of America is very much in doubt.
Well, ever since Reagan declared war on the middle class in 1981, busting PATCO and
that's
starting,
right.
You know,
and what we have got to ask ourselves, you know, and this, you know, in a sense gets back to the media and the corporate media, why shows like yours and Air American are doing such an important job, is the most important issues facing the American people are very rarely asked. So the question is, with all of the increase in technology, with all of the increase in worker productivity, why is the middle class shrinking? Why today is a two-income family? Does a two-income family have less disposable income than a one-income family did 30 years ago? Those are the kinds of questions that we should be asking, and certainly our disastrous trade policies are related to that whole issue.
Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. Brunch with Bernie, our first hour of every Friday program. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 866-440-8466. Bernie's website, bernie.org. Ours, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Once was a Greenspan guarding our economy. Bill made a surplus, that's good, Bill, said he. Then said the Bushman, if I make a deficit, you'll come up faulting Bill Clinton with me.
Faulting Bill Clinton, faulting Bill Clinton, you'll come up faulting Bill Clinton with me.
Then said the Bushman, if I make a deficit, you'll come up halting Bill Clinton with me.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media are afraid of. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS for the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things electronic. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie's website, bernie.org. You can drop into our live chat room over at tomhartman.com. Just click the live chat link, and our telephone number toll-free across the country, 866-440-8466. Bernie, Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire on the line. Hey, Brian, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, how are you? And good afternoon, Senator-elect Sanders.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay, I wanted to talk today about Social Security and national security. I think what we have in Washington, to me, it's an unelected regime that's using this thing called national security that is not at all a law on the Constitution or the founding documents of this nation. They're using it to invoke a kind of fascist rule in this country. And but as far as another real national security issue, Social Security, this president alone in his annual budgets to pay for his federal deficits and his tax cuts for the rich and his war profiteer buddies, they've already stolen basically $2.2 trillion from the Social Security annual surplus trust fund amount. That's the baby boomers' retirement amounts. That's what people have paid in. That's the surplus amount. There's no crisis in the Social Security system. As Dean Baker says, Tom, he's the one that wrote the book, Social Security, the Phony Crisis. They're about the trust fund and the budget. He's saying that at first it's essential to remember that Social Security is the lender in this story, not the borrower.
Brian, I got your point. Is there a question in there for Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, Al Gore, they ridiculed poor Al Gore for his lockbox idea, but when you're a new U.S. senator, would you introduce on the Senate floor a bill to introduce a Social Security lockbox for any president has to live by, regardless of party, that Social Security retirement funds are protected?
Okay,
let me
say a couple of things, because you raised
you raised
a lot of questions, Brian. In terms of Social Security, the president is lying, and I use that word advisedly, when he talks about his belief that Social Security is going bankrupt. Social Security is not going bankrupt, and in fact, with fairly modest changes, like lifting the cap in terms of what wealthier people should be contributing into the system, you will have Social Security strong and vibrant for the next 70 or 80 years. And with make some other changes, we're going to be good for the indefinite future. So that's issue number one. Number two, there is no question that the president is using national security issues, in my view, to frighten the American people. Terrorism is a serious business, and we should not ignore it. But there is real concern among people from a progressive perspective, from a conservative perspective, that this president has been assaulting our U.S. Constitution and our basic civil rights in an unprecedented manner. The idea that the phone calls of tens and tens of millions of innocent Americans are being collected in Washington, D.C., is clearly illegal and clearly an outrage. The idea that the NSA is able to tap American citizens' phone without a court warrant, to me, is clearly illegal, and on it goes. So of the many, many issues that we have to stay focused on, is the understanding is, yeah, terrorism is a very serious issue. There are people out there who want to do us harm. We've got to fight terrorism. We've got to protect the American people. But there's no question in my mind that we can do it in a way that does not undermine the constitutional rights that make us a free country.
Thank you. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I have a kind of a follow-up question from a question on immigration I had, and that is the Heritage Foundation figures that by 2016 it will cost us $56 billion a year in additional costs and only escalate from there. How are we going to pay for that if we have this amnesty rather than require a real ID and permit to work?
All right. In terms of the immigration issue, let me just say a few things. I find it interesting, Tom, that we have a president who's very much law and order guy, kind of guy. How many press conferences has the president held in Texas, in California, in front of factories who are employing illegal immigrants and pointing the finger at them?
Yeah, I've been saying for a long time, Bernie, we don't have an illegal immigration problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem in
this
country.
That's right. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that in the last number of years, until very recently, the number of investigations and legal actions taken against illegal employers who are illegally hiring people who are not American citizens, who are illegal immigrants, has been very, very minimal.
It was three last year.
Three?
Three investigations.
Yeah, well, yeah. There you go. That says a lot about the priorities of this administration.
Yeah, there you go. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. The Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Anyone can hack the files and push delete. There'd be no proof, and I got no receipt. Let's get the system under control, and the final results will match the exit polls. They lost my vote. It isn't fair. I took the stand. Doesn't anybody care? They lost my vote. Now do you know where did my ballot go? Whoa.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders here with us. His website, Bernie.org. Please check it out. Great news and information always there. And, of course, if you want to drop into our chat room, TomHartman.com, 866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Brian in Phoenix, Arizona. You are live with Bernie Sanders.
Tom, hello, Bernie.
Hi,
in late 2005, the Democrats forced a closed session to address Phase 2 and the investigation into the Iraq pre-war intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to that? My understanding was that the Republicans agreed to finish it by a certain date, and I believe that it's sometime this year.
I think you are right, and I think it's still up in the air. But I got to tell you, Brian, that this issue is something that is crying out for serious investigation. I don't have to tell you, and I think the listeners here, that there is an enormous amount of frustration and confusion in this country about why we went to war in the first place and about what the president knew and when he knew it. I can simply tell you that I, as a member of Congress, was in classified meetings hearing from Secretary Rumsfeld, then Secretary of State Colin Powell, telling us in closed meetings that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that were and that they were poised to attack the United States of America. On the other hand, what we know is you have people like the first Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, was saying in early cabinet meetings, well before 9/11, he was hearing Bush and others talk about the need to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Was the decision to go to war in Iraq made well before 9/11? Was 9/11 being used as a pretense for the war? Did the president cherry-pick information? What kind of intelligence came into his office which told him that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction? Those are the kinds of questions that the American people, I think, want answered. Unfortunately, and I sit on the Oversight Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, what I can tell you is when Bush was president, the guy couldn't sneeze without an investigation.
You mean when Clinton was president?
When Clinton was president, I'm sorry. Since Bush has been president, not one serious investigation of anything the Bush administration has done.
Seth in Austin, Texas. Seth, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, guys. Hey, basically, I wanted to know what Mr. Sanders thought about the signing statements. I heard George Bush's, after these laws have passed, about 750 signing statements have basically let him interpret as he chooses these laws. And I was wondering if Congress is doing anything or if they can do anything about them.
Well, of course Congress can do something about it. But what people have got to understand is you have a one-party government running this country right now. And the function of the House and the function of the Senate is not to act as independent bodies under our Constitution, but by and large, with some exceptions, to act as a rubber stamp for the President of the United States. In case people did not know what the caller was referring to, you have this absurd situation. Congress passes a law, and often the law results in strong debate and compromise and this, that, and the other thing. And then the President signs the bill, and he says, oh, by the way, I'm signing this law, bill into law, but of course I don't have to obey this section of it or that section of it because I disagree with it. I mean, that is just completely crazy. And there has been an effort from day one on the part of Bush Cheney, I suspect very strongly pushed by the vice president, to create what we call an imperial presidency, which is, you know, you don't have to worry about what Congress does. Who is Congress anyhow? You can pretty much do what you want to do. And these, and what this caller refers to about making it clear that you're not going to necessarily obey provisions in legislation that was passed is exactly part of that, and it is an outrage.
And in fact, Article 1 of the Constitution, the first part of the Constitution, defines Congress because the founders and framers felt that Congress should be the most important body of government because it's closest to the people.
Exactly. I mean, you have 435 members of the House. And if the president could say, oh, by the way, thanks for sending me up this bill, but of course I'm not going to obey it, what are we talking about?
Yeah. Lee and Cortes, Washington. No, I'm sorry. Scott in San Diego, California. Scott, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Scott? No, Scott. Okay, let's go to Lee in Anacortes, Washington then. Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Anacortes, Washington, Lee?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, hi. Bernie and Tom, I'd like to know what you think of Senator Simpson's proposal for voter reform, or even if you know about it.
Well, there are a lot of reforms out there. Why don't you briefly tell us about Senator Simpson?
Well, I saw a blurb on, I think it was CNN not long ago, where he came on and said that he wanted to get the corporate influence out of our voting process, and that's exactly what we've been talking about on this show for a long time.
Hmm. Well, we sure do. I'm not quite familiar with Senator Simpson's proposal, but to my view, one of the concerns that I have as a nation is that we have voter turnouts that are substantially lower than many other industrialized countries. And one of the reasons, the major reason, is a lot of people have given up on the political process because they see a Washington dominated by big money interests, people who are prepared to give tax breaks to billionaires but not raise a minimum wage above $5.15 an hour nationally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is another problem, and that is also compared to other countries, we make it very difficult for people to vote and participate in elections. For example, it is right now in America, believe me, they know if you don't pay your taxes. But on the other hand, you have to go and register to vote. rather than being automatically registered when you're 18 years of age. We don't have same-day registration in the state of Vermont and all over this country. There are states where a week before the election, if somebody says, gee, I finally really want to get involved, I want to vote, they walk into their town clerk and it's too late for them to vote. I think we should obviously be very careful about voter fraud, but the goal should be to reach out to encourage people in whatever way to vote, to have a very high voter turnout. That's the goal that we should be doing. And unfortunately now, there are Republican initiatives in Georgia and other states that are moving in exactly the other direction, trying to suppress the vote, making it harder for people, especially lower-income people and minorities, to vote. And I am very concerned about that.
Shirley in Evansville, Indiana, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Congressman. My question is, when is Congress going to yank the paper crown off of Bush's head and remind him that he is a president and not a king? This rumor about the superhighway from Mexico, and then you hear rumors that by 2010 we're going to have open borders and North America's going to have a common currency. Why should three men make such decisions for a continent? Why isn't Congress, why doesn't he talk to Congress about this before he even discusses it outside of the country?
Well, as I mentioned, that's a very, very good question. And I think the answer is that paper crown on his head is not going to be taken off so long as the Republicans continue to control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And that's why the election 4 months from now is so very, very important. If the Democrats control either the House or the Senate, and or hopefully both, suddenly, and I'm not going to tell you that everything is going to change, the Democrats are going to do everything great, that ain't going to happen. But I think you will begin to hear, for the first time since Bush has been president, some very serious questions about the actions of his administration. But right now, in both the House and the Senate, they have pretty much said, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want to do. Don't worry about us. We're not going to ask you hard questions. And I think that that is an absolute dereliction of the constitutional responsibility of oversight on the part of Congress. I think it's really, really bad.
Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I was just curious if you had heard about the new San Francisco health care program and what your opinion of it was.
I heard a little bit. I was out in San Francisco a couple of months ago, and I think they're making some progress.
It was just announced today in the newspapers.
Okay, but I heard some talk about it. Well, without going into all of the details, clearly the goal of what health care in America has got to be is that every man, woman, and child has health care as a right of citizenship, period. What people do not understand is that our current system is the most wasteful, bureaucratic, and expensive by far in the entire industrialized world. We spend at least twice as much per person on health care as any other nation, and yet if you look at the indices in terms of longevity, infant mortality, we are not doing particularly well. So I think we need fundamental changes in the way we do health care in this country, a simple system which is designed to provide quality health care to our people as a right, not the kind of profiteering that we currently see where CEOs make huge sums of money, we have all kinds of advertising, et cetera, et cetera. So we need a real fundamental change in the way we do health care in America, and we can do that. We can guarantee health care to all of our people without spending a nickel more than we're currently spending because we have so much waste and so much bureaucracy within the current system.
And yet whenever any member of Congress talks like that, they get enormous pushback from the lobby.
Well, the reason we are where we are is because of the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, and those medical equipment suppliers who make a fortune amidst all of the chaos in the system right now.
And Billy Towson and company now?
All right. Well, Billy Towson, well, that was a beauty. Billy Towson helped write the prescription drug Medicare bill, and guess where he's working today? Shock of all shocks, he's working for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, that's how it works. Man, we've got to fix that. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. His website, Bernie.org. If you want to drop into our live chat room, our website, TomHartmann.com, however you spell it, will get you there. Our number, 866-440-8466. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartmann.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Every breath you take, every call you make, every bite of steak, for our nation's sake, we'll be watching you. Every single day, we'll check your dossier. We see where you pray, what you buy, what you pay, because we're watching you.
The official Bush administration anthem. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Your daily, minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Barbara in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Did you say Barbara in Seattle?
I did.
Okay. Bernie and Tom, just in realizing that I may be just getting stuck on something, and just a comment. The Republicans seem so good at putting a spin on things. And I noticed that we spent all this money when he went to Austria for his protection, and I think the Austrians had to spend some money also. And it seems like he's always telling us how safe we should feel, but apparently he doesn't feel very safe when he travels. And another thing is, when he traveled to Washington State last weekend, and it cost, $60,000 an hour for that airplane to run. Round trip is at least $600,000. And with everything that he's doing, that's probably a drop in the bucket for what we're spending for him to go on these little escapades for the RNC, when he's not even running for reelection.
So, Barbara, a question there for Bernie?
And so, I mean, is there any way that we can, get reimbursed for this guy doing all this stuff?
Well, Barbara raises a question that's been touched on earlier in the program, and that is the issue of oversight. Obviously, the president has the right to travel, no question about that. And when he travels in a dangerous world, he needs protection. I don't argue that, and I don't begrudge him that. On the other hand, to what degree is the president – in fact, fully compensating the government for political trips. When you do a political trip, it should be paid for by the political party. And that may well be the case, but that's a kind of discussion that should be taking place.
Yeah, well said. Bobby in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, guys. Yesterday, the Voting Rights Act fell through the cracks.
Yes.
And you were just talking about voting, and my question is, why don't we have mandatory voting? And if this has been proposed in the Congress, what's been the history of that?
It has been talked about a little bit, and the argument against it is, gee, what kind of voter would you have if you fined that person if he didn't vote? Is that a responsible citizen? I'm not so sure. In some countries, I think, Australia has mandatory voting?
Yeah, it's a $25 fine if you fail to vote, and they get about 97% compliance.
Well, I mean, no, it's an idea. But I think the major question that we have got to ask ourselves is why people feel so alienated from the political process, why the voter turnout in the United States is substantially less than it is in Canada or in Europe, and what it says about how people feel about the relevance of government here to their lives. Also, I think we have got to clearly make the process, as I mentioned earlier, much easier, including same-day registration.
Yeah, you've heard my Paul Weyrich clip about Republicans trying to get leverage by driving down voting, Bernie.
I didn't hear it, but it is that what he said?
Well, yeah, it's just 20 seconds. Let me play it for you, and I'd like to get your response to this. This is Paul Weyrich, the guy who claims credit for putting Ronald Reagan into office.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And thus they run negative ads that cause people not to show up at the polls.
That is an incredible statement.
Yeah. He was talking in a church to a group of Republican Christian activists.
So they want low voter turnouts.
And that was about 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's being at least honest and straightforward. That is the Republican strategy. They understand that when voter turnout is low. That means a lot of working people, lower income people, are not voting for their interest, and it's more middle class and upper class who are voting, and that's precisely what the Republicans want. They want elections in which the wealthy vote and the wealthy contribute to the candidates of their choice, and that's their definition of a vibrant democracy.
Yeah. Marie in Vashon, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Marie?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Thank you, Rep. Sanders. I appreciate all you do, and I feel like there's hope for the future when I listen to you.
Thank you.
I had a couple things, but I'll keep it short.
We only have about a minute and a half, Marie. So.
Okay. When Bush was talking about North Korea the other day, he was talking about a non-transparent government. I thought that was ironic, considering what kind of government we have. And I wanted to talk about the spying. They had enough information during 9/11 to stop it. They just hadn't translated it yet. So how do they expect to stop anything with all the information they're gathering now with spying on their own citizens?
Yes. Well, there is a lot of evidence out there that they have. Your point is they have so much material that we don't have the resources or the capability of sorting through it. And I think that that is a very, very valid point. But above and beyond that, the idea of assembling telephone calls, collecting the telephone calls of tens of millions of innocent Americans is clearly an outrage. It is clearly, to my mind, illegal, and it's something that has to stop.
And today we learned they're taking our bank records, too.
Well, there you go.
On the front page of the New York Times. Amazing. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great having you on the program.
Thank
our
you.
Brunch with Bernie segment. Coming up next, conservative David Tebow says abstinence only till marriage programs should only be taught in schools, nothing else. I'll be confronting David on the facts that say that these programs don't work. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, The Democracy Zone. We'll be right back, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. David Tebow is with us with CNS News, the conservative cybercast news service, cnsnews.com. He's the editor-in-chief there. David Tebow, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you again, Tom.
Always good talking with you, David, even though we disagree on pretty much everything, it seems. We can have a civil conversation from time to time. When Bush came into office, well, really this goes back to Reagan. Since the early 1980s, Reagan has been trying to shove abstinence-only, basically, I would suggest, religious-based sex ed into sex ed classes and replace just good old fashioned discussion of reproductive choices, birth
abortion,
control, condoms,
right?
Abortion, sure, yeah, the whole spectrum. Trying to replace discussion of all those things with abstinence only education. And you're concerned, if I'm reading this article right, Randy Hall wrote this article, No More Money for Abstinence Education, you're concerned that abstinence-only education is going to lose funding. Am I taking this right?
Actually, you know, the National Abortion Federation has been the organization complaining about the funding. They're afraid that crisis pregnancy centers, which offer abstinence-only education and try to counsel people, not young women, not to have abortions, is getting some of their funding. The interesting thing is that the crisis pregnancy centers, Tom, have gotten a couple of $1 million a year. And Planned Parenthood gets $272.2 million from American taxpayers in just 2005 alone.
What does this have to do with whether or not our kids in our junior high schools and high schools are being taught sex education that includes information about condoms, includes information about a whole range of birth control, that includes information about abortion, that includes information about sexually transmitted diseases, versus receiving sex ed classes in high schools and junior high schools that simply says, there's all this horrible stuff out there, just don't have sex, period.
Well, it's a snapshot of just how stacked it is in favor of the, as you call it, comprehensive sex education that includes education about killing babies. And that's what you and your liberal ilk would have every student in America learn about. But abstinence-only education...
Abortion does exist, doesn't it, David?
Unfortunately, yes. And
okay, then you think that people shouldn't talk about something that exists? You think that's going to make it go away?
I don't think we should encourage it. Do you?
I don't think abortion should be encouraged either, no. And I don't think anybody thinks that abortion should be encouraged. I think that every rational person I've ever talked to, liberal, conservative, or halfway in between, is of the opinion that we want to minimize the number of abortions in America.
Really,
and the experience indicates... let me finish my sentence, David.
Okay.
Experience indicates that the best way to minimize abortions is to minimize unwanted pregnancies. And an abstinence-only education has been demonstrated not only not to minimize unwanted pregnancies, but these kids who only have abstinence-only education or take the so-called virginity pledge are more likely than students who have comprehensive sex education to end up with unwanted pregnancies.
There is a faulty assumption in your rationale, and that is that abstinence-only education will have children having sex even though they've promised not to. Now, you know, that's a moral failure. That doesn't mean that abstinence-only education isn't a good program just because some kids fail to live up to the standard. It's a standard that we ought to have in place because it's a good moral standard for young people who should not be having sex before they're old enough to understand all of the ramifications of it.
You know, I agree with you, David, that that kids shouldn't be having sex before they can understand the ramifications of it. In fact, I think, you know, broadly speaking, as a society, this is something that I think reasonable people can debate, probably shouldn't even be having sex before they're really sure that this is going to be the long-term relationship that they're going to have.
Right.
Which many people would define as being married or being engaged or whatever. But nonetheless, We also agree that running into a telephone pole at 60 miles an hour with a car is something that should never happen. And yet we put airbags in our cars so that if we run into a telephone pole at 60 miles an hour, we'll be protected. There are going to be kids who are going to experience moral failures, just as there are automobiles that experience failures driving down the street. And shouldn't those kids have the backup, to have the backup of the simple information, the knowledge that if they're going to experience a moral failure, or whatever you want to call it, that at least they can avoid getting AIDS or they can avoid getting pregnant?
Well, to use your analogy, which I think is kind of clever, using the car in your case and children using condoms would be like putting battering rams on your car because you expect to get into a crash, you know? If you're going
No, battering ram is not a defensive device.
Well, something that encourages or incites the activity. And Tom, if you give condoms and other birth control devices to children and you say, you know, if it happens, be prepared, what do you think that's giving them in terms of a message?
Well, what the studies show is that those kids who are taught basic sex education in a fundamentally unbiased way that doesn't offer even, frankly, moral judgments. It simply says, here's how the human body works, here's how sex works, here are the diseases you can get, here's how you can avoid getting the diseases, here's what pregnancy is, here's how you can avoid getting pregnant, here's what abortion is, here's, you know, the consequences of that. Just the whole spectrum. Those kids are less likely to end up with unwanted pregnancies, and I would argue probably thus unwanted abortions, than are kids who are simply told, you know, sex is something that people do when they grow up, and we're not going to talk about it any more than that because you should just say no.
I think the statistics that you were citing come from, the West Coast and the Northeast, but don't take into consideration that large swath of America that is still culturally conservative and still has high moral standards.
You know, the state that has the lowest divorce rate in the nation, David.
Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Now, that's an anomaly. I can't figure that one out.
Now, the study, I'm looking at five studies here. You're probably familiar with them. The AGI study in 2003, the Jemmett study in 1998, the Kirby study in 99, the Kirby study in 2000, and the Narell study in 98. I'm sure the Narell study you would immediately throw out. But, I mean, this, I don't know of any studies that have been done that indicate that abstinence only is helpful. In fact, the experience in Uganda, I mean, I've worked in Uganda. I've for 2 years, on and off, I worked in Uganda, and I have friends in Uganda right this minute. And in Uganda, they had a comprehensive program, sex education program, nationwide, and condoms were widely available, and they talked about condoms. Bush comes into office. He passes a bunch of money to Museveni, the guy who's running Uganda, and says, let's just do abstinence only. And now, now over the last 2 years, since they went to abstinence only education, the HIV infection rate is spiking in Uganda. People are dying because of the I don't want to say the religion that you're espousing, but I lack a better word.
Well, see, Tom, I think you see it as religious based, and I see it as morals based. I see it as the difference between right and wrong, and that doesn't necessarily mean a religious connotation.
Well, I didn't mean that. You know, what I'm saying is that you're taking it as an article of faith, that if you simply tell people, don't have sex, that they will do it. And I'm saying, let's be practical here. I think it's better that people don't die of HIV and that we don't have unwanted pregnancies and thus more abortions. And the evidence indicates, those of us who are living in the reality-based world, the evidence indicates, the evidence of Uganda, I'm telling you, check it out. First-person experience. I'm telling you, the evidence of Uganda, if you make condoms available and you inform people about sex education, they're less likely to die of AIDS and you're not going to end up with the orphans that my organization is caring for right now in Uganda.
I can't argue with you about the culture in Uganda. You know more about it than me. In the United
States, it's not that
States,
difference in the culture here.
In the United States,
they speak English
dealing,
and everything.
We are dealing with decisions by young people that don't only involve STDs and unwanted pregnancy. There are a whole host of psychological and emotional ramifications from having sex before you are mature enough to handle it.
And we should be teaching that to kids.
With abstinence-only education.
We should be teaching that to kids in the context of, why would you not want your children to know what a condom is or how it works?
I would not want my 13-year-old to know how to use condoms.
Why?
Because it's going to encourage her to have sex.
So you think your 13-year-old is so morally weak that if she knows that a condom is available, that's going to cause her to go looking for a guy?
I don't have to go down that road, Tom, because...
Well, that's what you just said!
Because we've had lots of discussions about how important it is to do the right thing, not to get yourself in that position.
Then why are you afraid of her knowing about a condom?
Well, she's going to learn about it, you know, just because our culture barrages kids with this kind
of... Then why would you want her to learn misinformation? What if somebody tells her that if she keeps the condom in her front pocket, then she's going to be protected, and she thinks that that's...
Inexorably, you cannot teach a child about condom use without them getting the idea that it's okay to have sex.
I guess we'll just have to disagree on that. David Tebow, the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. David, thanks for being on the program here and talking with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. After the break, an update from inside the White House with Talk Radio News. And then we'll be taking your calls and more. Pile of news today. 16 minutes past here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's right. It's one of my favorite songs from back home. Home on the Range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way. Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. Home, home on the range, where the beer and the cantaloupe lay, where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so, then it's one I can say.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Special happy birthday greetings today to our producer, David Poole. Hey, congratulations, David. You made it through another one here. How old are you now? Or you not want to say that on the air?
No, I'm 22 today.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm 29.
29. Yeah, not bad. Pretty soon you'll start doing like me. This is the 10th anniversary of my 30th birthday, right? That kind of thing. Okay, well, good on you.
Thank you.
And having survived this long, that's pretty good in this world these days. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk to David.
David Tebow.
Yes, but you'll do great.
Okay.
I heard you this morning. You guys never sleep.
We're doing a lot of work these days.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it. I mean, there are people out there doing two shifts, you know, laying bricks and you know, cops who are working two shifts and things. I mean, there's people doing really hard work. I sit here and talk on the radio.
Yeah,
it's, you know, there's some thinking involved, but I don't think of it as.
Well, we're not complaining.
Well, yeah, me neither.
I called because I wanted to say that I was from the Northeast and I was going to get them. You know, and I'm a liberal, and I'm an ilk, and whatever else that he claims that we are. But you know, all kidding aside, both my sons have had comprehensive sex education, and my older son has been married now for 4 weeks, and he's disease free, and he's happy. And my younger son is going to be 14, and we've always had a loving, safe environment in the home to discuss all the issues that sex. Human sexuality touches. You know, if something comes up on TV or something comes up in the social setting, you know, we always have the arsenal of tools with which to discuss these things, and it's within a moral context because my younger son has already gone through the OWL program our whole lives in our church, and my older son was fortunate enough to have it in school whenever they had the funding for it. So it's been very beneficial, and my younger son also took gun safety classes. I didn't want him to go out and go hunting with a gun until he understood it.
Yeah.
And he talks about hunting not like a hot dog, but, you know, the camaraderie of hunting, the fun part of looking for, you know, the critters that he has to kill, unfortunately. But, you know, it's not like a hot dog thing like, oh, I got a gun, and, you know, he's not talking about, oh, it felt great whenever I shot it or
any
of those kind of things. He's very responsible about it.
Yeah.
And he's only going to be 14. You know,
I think that's marvelous. And with regard to, in particular, with regard to the sex education part of it, my concern is that if we don't teach our kids about these things, they are, as David pointed out, they are going to hear about it. But they're going to hear myths and misinformation. I mean, back when I was a kid, the main myth that went around because there were a lot of schools that didn't have sex education classes, the main myth was that if the man withdrew before orgasm, that pregnancy couldn't occur. And that, you know, it diminishes the probability. But it doesn't take it to zero. And there were a lot of unnecessary or unwanted pregnancies as a result of that. Or, on the other hand, a lot of, you know, people who, you know, just didn't, that was the plan, but it didn't quite work out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. And number two, one of the more common myths that's going around now among kids, particularly preteens right now in our society, is that oral sex is a way to avoid disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so oral sex is exploding in America right now, and diseases like chlamydia that can be easily transmitted, gonorrhea and syphilis, are starting to make a rise in our teen and preteen populations in the United States because they aren't getting sex education. Instead, they're hearing these myths on the street, and they're believing them. They think that it makes a certain amount, oh, that must not be sex. And I think that it's just really dangerous for us to just say, don't do it, because there's always going to be some wrong story out there.
And there's more than just the myths about sex that the kids create. There's also a narrative that's going around this being a born-again virgin that, okay, so they backslide and they have sex and, you know, then they can go back to being a born-again virgin. So they have like a little caveat, you know, always in their back pocket. So, you know, I think there's, you know, it's dangerous to teach that.
Yeah, that's my position as well. Bonnie, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. Good to
Bye.
Hear from you. Chris in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk to Bernie, but you'll do okay, I guess.
Okay, we have about 20, 30 seconds. Something quick?
Basically, a lot of people talk about bad things about politicians, but back in the early 90s, I worked in a shoe store, and it was January night, and it was cold. It's in, you know, Burlington, Vermont in January, and Bernie actually came in with a homeless man, and I'd seen him around before and obviously knew who Bernie was, and he was nice enough to buy this gentleman some boots, some winter boots, and some warm socks.
Amazing. Yeah, and that's the kind of stuff Bernie does without an audience.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yeah. Chris, thanks for sharing that story with us. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
My name's O.W.N.41's my part. We hope you enjoy shocking up. Halliburton's here to stay. No electricity today. Hold those in your blues away.
My and welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones, our senior Tony Snow correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, indeed, I am your Tony Snow correspondent. Tony Snow today obfuscated and eviscerated facts in a masterful way. I think she had spent the entire morning. The briefing was scheduled for 10:30. They moved it back to 11. I think that's because they were going through the 9-page New York Times piece on basically financial spying and trying to come up with their repudiations, which they did come up with.
And what, for our listeners who don't know, the New York Times this morning broke the story. And unlike the NSA spying story, where the administration asked the New York Times not to talk about it, and they sat on it for over a year, certainly over an election cycle, so that it wouldn't harm Bush in the 2004 election, they didn't sit on this story. And they said that in the article. They said that the administration asked them not to publish it, but they were going ahead and publishing it anyway. And basically, what they did with our phone records, they're now doing with our bank records. That's the bottom line.
Exactly. And part of Tony Snow's premise seems to be that people don't mind and that people don't object to this,
mm-hmm.
that we're keeping them safe and that any way we can do it, that they have a right to do it. There's an executive order. He quoted the number of the executive order, and that it's entirely legal.
In other words, because George Bush wrote an executive order saying that he could do it, therefore he can do it.
Well, he said there were laws to back it up. Helen Thomas, who heckled him throughout the proceeding, asked him to provide the law, what laws it was. He said he wasn't a lawyer, and he couldn't provide it. She said, well, you should have found out before the briefing what the law was. He said that he would find out the law and get back to us.
I mean, this is Helen Thomas, who used to give, you know, Dwight Eisenhower a hard time. Harry Truman, I mean, was Truman the first president that she covered?
I think she goes back that far. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me the how little respect the Bush administration has for the press in general and the truth and facts in particular.
Well, one of the arguments was that basically nobody objects to any of this except the press. That was the basic argument. It was that you all are the only people who are objecting to this. That the American people are pleased that we are keeping them safe. And another argument was, in terms of mining for data, was that, okay, so what if CNN took the information that they have on people and used it? What's the difference between that and what the government is doing? And everybody looked sort of a bit puzzled by that. But that was clear. That was one of the things they'd come up with during the course of the morning over coffee and muffins.
Amazing. Amazing. Anything else? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I asked a question about prisoners in Guantanamo. While Bush was overseas earlier in the week, he made what I thought was an astonishing statement, a very loud and angry statement about they're cold-blooded killers, and if we let them loose, they'll kill again. We're going to put them on trial. And I thought to myself, well, if they're cold-blooded killers, then you've already decided that. What's the point of a trial?
Yeah.
So I asked Tony Snow that question, whether there was any presumption of innocence whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, of course there is, and then proceeded to pretty much say again that they were cold-blooded killers. So
the people in Guantanamo.
The people in Guantanamo, yes.
Yeah.
But they're going to get a trial, despite the fact that we already know that they're cold-blooded killers.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, 34 of them that for whom the administration could find no witnesses to exonerate them. I believe it was the Associated Press recently did this tracking down their witnesses. One of them was like the assistant to Hamid Karzai. The guy was available. Another was working in Washington, D.C. I mean, the Bush administration refused to produce the witnesses that would exonerate these 34 people in Guantanamo. Just said, sorry, not going to do it.
Well, I mean, the other question I asked was to Tony Snow, in talking about the New York Times article, said that after September the 11th, things change, and in fighting terror, we use every means at our disposal. And I asked him to define that phrase. What is every means at our disposal? But he did have the grace to say that maybe he was guilty of loose verbiage, and he actually meant every means that was legal.
Yeah. After 9/11, everything changed. What? After Pearl Harbor, everything changed. After Archduke Ferdinand was shot, everything changed. After the Civil War, everything changed. Oh, it's amazing. You know, the British occupied and burned the White House in the War of 1812, and James Madison, the president, didn't think that it was necessary to abridge the Bill of Rights. I mean,
apparently everything didn't change.
Talk about, you know, you've got a real problem. You've got foreign troops on your soil taking over the White House, and that wasn't grounds to end the constitutional protections that we have. But, you know, blowing up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, that'll do it. That's enough to do.
Everything changed, Tom. You just don't get with the program, do you?
Yeah, there you go. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Victoria, thank you for being with
us
today.
Thank you very much.
Always good speaking with you. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. And John in Seattle, Washington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today? John?
Hello?
Hey, John, you're live and on the air.
Yes, I wanted to talk to the gentleman about the abortion issue.
Yeah, he's gone, but we can discuss it if you'd like.
The problem is, the way I see it, if they get rid of abortion, you'll have couples who will be either incapable of having more children because of psychological reasons or financial reasons. And they don't talk about addressing that issue.
I don't follow your logic.
Well, they won't be able to afford children. Already, and more children than they already have.
I still, you know, how does making abortion illegal cause people to diminish the ability of couples to have children?
If they make abortions illegal,
right,
couples will end up having, women will get pregnant, the partners will have children the parents will not be capable, because they will not be psychological or financially capable of raising those children in the right way.
Oh, I see. Yeah, this is the argument that the Freakonomics guys make, that when abortion became legal about 15, 20 years later, you saw a dramatic drop in the crime rate. And the reason why was because there were fewer unwanted children. Unwanted children grow up to be problem children who grow up to be criminals, basically.
Right. And then further on, after a while, these unwanted children will end up being a serial rapist, murderers, and or pedophiles.
Yeah, and on the list goes. I mean, there's no shortage of crimes that you can add to that. John, interesting point. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Keith in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Well, I've got a couple questions I'd like to ask you, Tom. Where is Colin Powell in all these hearings and stuff like that? Is he taking the party line of the Republicans and falling on the sword for these guys? I mean, you know, he was pretty much duped as much as the rest of us, you know?
Well, perhaps. Colin Powell, before he was brought in to be Secretary of State, was, you know, doing very nicely, thank you very much, as a member of the board of directors of AOL, Time Warner, CNN, et cetera, you know, that media empire. And I don't know right now. I'd have to go to theyrule.net and plug his name into their search engine, which I think I'll probably do over the next break. But my guess is that Colin Powell is back to doing that same thing, which is being a professional director for some of America's largest corporations and being paid very well for doing it, thank you very much. And as such, he doesn't want to rock the boat. That's just my guess.
Yeah, but you would think he would have some kind of information. I mean, he was made to look like a fool. I watched a show on one of the cables last week called Dead Wrong. I don't know if you watched it or whatever.
No, I didn't.
It was pretty blatant. It was pretty much anti-Bush and telling everybody just exactly that.
Oh, is this the CNN special you're talking
about? Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. See, the thing is, Keith, that these guys understand that if they're part of the system, if they go along, then they can get along. If Colin Powell just kind of keeps his mouth quiet or his mouth shut, then, you know, he'll have an opportunity to build a multi-million dollar fortune. And, I mean, he was the first member of his family, as far as I know, to actually go to college as a result of affirmative action programs and the fact that that he's brilliant. You know, the confluence of those two things. You know, society changed in very significant ways in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and provided opportunities for people like Colin Powell. And his son, Michael Powell, he wanted his son to do well. Part of his deal was, okay, I'll leave the corporate sector and all this money I'm making and work in the State Department. You know, give my son a job. His son gets a job as the head of the FCC. When Colin Powell even deviates a little bit from the party line, Bush throws him out and throws his son out the same week. And it's the Bush, it's this basic mafia mentality, the Republican mentality of saying, you know, you cross us and you're toast. And I have a strong suspicion that while Paul O'Neill, for example, the first Treasury Secretary, he was willing to speak out because he was worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars to begin with. He'd already made his money. He didn't care. He was willing to speak the truth. But Colin Powell, not. I mean, he'd been a professional soldier all his life. Probably the highest paycheck he'd ever had before he went into the corporate world after the Gulf War was probably, you know, in the neighborhood of $100,000 a year. So I think that, you know, Colin Powell, and he's just looking out for himself and his family, and there's probably a lot of folks like him out there.
Can I ask you another question,
sure,
please?
Sure. Yeah, we have about a minute.
Okay. What's taking so long to get the Iraqi army up and running? Our guys get 90 days of basic training, and they're out there in harm's way and stuff like that. These guys are taking 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Why are they dragging their feet? Because we're going to support them or what?
No, because if you join the Iraqi army right now in Iraq, an army that is perceived as being the tool of American foreign policy, and the Americans are perceived as being the nasty occupiers who are here to steal our oil. If you join the Iraqi army, you yourself become a target. Your family becomes a target. Your cousins and nephews and aunts and uncles and parents and children become targets. Your house might get burned down. I mean, people are scared. You read over this thing from Khalilzad, our ambassador to Baghdad, this private memo that he sent back last week. We talked about on the air earlier in the week. Where he says, you know, our employees, they have to go incognito. A third of the employees at the U.S. Embassy are telling the rest of the world that they don't work for the U.S. Embassy. It's the same thing with the Army. It's like putting a bullseye on your back, and so that's what happens. And then you got this situation where we're finding that the Iraqi soldiers, in some cases, are actually turning and shooting at Americans who are training them. So it's going to be a mess until we back out of there. That's what we've got to do. We've got to back out. The state of emergency declared in Iraq. More on that right after this. 46 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. In just a few seconds. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. This news just in from the Associated Press. The Iraqi government declared a state of emergency and imposed a curfew Friday after insurgents set up roadblocks in central Baghdad and opened fire on U.S. and Iraqi troops outside the heavily fortified Green Zone. This sounds like a civil war has been acknowledged by the Iraqi government, the new Iraqi government. Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki ordered everyone off the streets of the capital. U.S. and Iraqi forces also fought gunmen in the volatile Dora neighborhood in south Baghdad. A car bomb ripped through a market and a nearby gas station in the increasingly violent southern city of Basra, killing at least 5 people and wounding 18, including 2 policemen. A bomb also struck a Sunni mosque in Habib, northeast of Baghdad, killing 10 worshippers and wounding 15 in the town where Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was slain this month. At least 19 other deaths were reported in Baghdad. Throughout the morning, Iraqi and U.S. military forces clashed with attackers armed with rocket-propelled grenades, hand grenades, and rifles in busy Haifa Street, which runs into the Green Zone, site of the U.S. and British embassies and the Iraqi government. Four Iraqi soldiers and three policemen were wounded in the fighting, Police Lieutenant Maitham Abdul Razak said. The region was sealed, and Iraqi and U.S. forces conducted house-to-house searches. The Prime Minister's office said the curfew would last from 2 p.m. Friday until 6 a.m. Saturday, but later shortened it to end at 5 p.m. Friday. The state of emergency includes a ban on carrying weapons and gives Iraqi security forces broader arrest powers, Defense Ministry official Major General Abdul Aziz Mohammed Jassim said. He said the state of emergency and the curfew came in the wake of today's clashes to let the army work freely to chase militants and to avoid casualties among civilians. They will punish all those who have weapons with them, and they can shoot them if they feel they are in danger. Which raises the question, if this government is perceived as being a Shia government, and this is a Sunni uprising, does this mean, number one, that the Sunnis would continue to carry guns and thus the Shia militia, the military, would go after them? Or, on the other hand, what about the followers of Sadr, Muqtada al-Sadr, the guy whose men killed Cindy Sheehan's son? He has a whole branch within, you know, a branch, basically a wing of one of the parties in this government. He's one of the major power brokers in this government. And, of course, a Shiite cleric in Baghdad. And he's got his own private army. He's got a couple hundred thousand guys who are carrying machine guns loyal to him. Does this mean that the government is going to try to disarm them? And what happens if the government tries to disarm the Shia militias? My guess is that if they try to disarm the Shia militia, it's really going to melt down, which then means that the Sunnis are going to say, oh, the Shia can have all the guns they want, but we can't, which is going to then perpetuate. And, you know, where do we go with all this thing? We're back to Joe Biden's suggestion of several months ago that we should simply split the country up into three parts, a Sunni area, a Shia area, and a Kurdish area, and move folks out of each of those areas and into other areas respectively, and reimburse them and pay, and essentially ethnically cleanse all three areas, but do it with money and facilitate it rather than doing it with a bullet to the head, which is how it's being done right now. Because we have opened this can of worms, we uncorked this bot, you know, whatever lousy metaphor you want to use. Should we resolve it by simply staying there and saying, here we are, we're going to use force? I mean, this is the only thing that George W. Bush and the guys around him know how to do is to punish. They don't know how to negotiate. They don't know how to talk. They don't know how to work things out. They don't play well with others. And punishment has limits. There is a certain point at which you can punish people so hard that they finally say, okay, that's fine. We're willing to die. This is what the founders of this country came to. They came to the point where they said, we're willing to die rather than live under you guys. And that's obviously what's happening in Iraq right now. The news story goes on to say, gunmen also attacked a group of worshippers marching from Sadr City, the Shiite slum in eastern Baghdad, to the Baratha Mosque on the other side of the city to protest a suicide attack a week ago on the revered Shiite shrine. At least one marcher was killed and four were wounded. Now we're back to Sunnis versus Shia. The U.S. military also said two U.S. Marines were killed during combat in the volatile Anbar province in separate attacks on Wednesday and Thursday, and a soldier died elsewhere in a non-combat incident on Wednesday. This raises the deaths to 2,515 members of the U.S. military who have died since the Iraq War started in March of 2003. I'd like to know the number since the occupation began in May of 2003. I think it'd probably be around, what, 2,300? Al-Maliki has been trying to rein in unrelenting insurgent and sectarian violence. He launched a massive security operation in Baghdad 10 days ago, deploying tens of thousands of troops who flooded the city, snarling traffic with hundreds of checkpoints. Apparently, he's getting some blowback. So we'll see how this thing goes. Spencer Overton, the author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, will be with us right after the break. That, your calls and more news. The Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Some absolutely incredible news today. This on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, just laying it right out. And this is the beginning, well, not the beginning, this is the ongoing war against the American middle class. And it is so important that people understand that there is a war going on in the United States. It's not the war in Iraq. That is not a war. That is, A, that's an occupation, and B, that's really a giant feeding frenzy for Bush and his buddies. All of his corporate buddies who are making out like bandits over there. But there's basically good news and bad news in the media today. The good news, first of all, this from Joan Biskupic in USA Today. The Supreme Court on Thursday enhanced workers' ability to win money damages when employers retaliate against them for filing discrimination complaints. Now, you would think this is kind of common sense. And, in fact, the Supreme Court voted unanimously on behalf of this woman, Sheila White, who is an employee of the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. She accused a supervisor of sexual harassment, and what did he do? He transferred her to a job that was, it is described here as a dirtier job on the tracks, on the railroad tracks. In other words, he punished her for reporting him. And she sued for $43,500. She had complained about conditions on the job. She was suspended without pay for 37 days. So she sued for $43,500, which is presumably big bucks for a worker with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. And the Supreme Court unanimously held that you can't do that. Now, here's the kicker. Even the right-wingers on the court agreed you can't do that. Right? Even the Supreme, even Scalia, Alito, Thomas, Roberts, even the right-wingers on the court agreed you can't do that to employees. And USA Today notes in their article on it, in the fourth paragraph, that standard, this being the standard that the Supreme Court established today, that you can't trash an employee because they've reported sexual harassment on the job, that standard is more favorable to workers than what has been used in most federal courts and what was backed by the Bush administration. Did the lights and buzzers just go off in your, that standard is more favorable than what has been used by the Bush administration? Say what? I mean,
they're in everybody's eggs.
Indeed. They certainly are. So Breyer said, Justice Stephen Breyer said that what constitutes retaliation would depend on the facts of a situation. He said that when a boss changes a worker's schedule, it may make the difference to many workers. It may make little difference to many workers, but may matter enormously to a young mother with school-aged children. Carter Phillips, who represented the railroad, said the court standard will be difficult for employers and judges to apply. Why? Well, he says, is the average employer going to know that a woman whose shift has been changed, presumably in retaliation, has a child at home? Well, I would say, Carter Phillips, yes! The employer should know that. You should at least, you know, there should be a level of supervision where at least the supervisors know the circumstances of the lives of their employees. Yes. And if they don't, they're going to have to find out now. I mean, what this reflects is a mentality that workers, producers in our society, the word that we used to use, are just merchandise. They're just products. Yeah, it's just producers. They're not capitalists. They're not the big cheese. Now, the other side of this story, today's Wall Street Journal, the front page of the Wall Street Journal, hidden burden. As workers' pensions wither, those for executives flourish. Now, keep in mind the difference between a pension and a 401k. I think a lot of people don't know this difference. The media has not gone to great lengths to explain it to people, and you can bet that the Republicans are not going to be explaining it to you. And why would the media not be explaining it to you? Because they don't even want their own employees to know, because most of the media is aggressively in the process of shifting what few pensions are left to 401ks themselves. A pension is when you retire, you get a check for a certain amount for the rest of your life until the day you die. It is basically the back end of an insurance policy. Pensions are put together much like insurance policies are. Everybody pays into them throughout the years that they work. And there's this shared pool of money. Now, some people are going to, you know, let's say the average person puts in enough money that they can live for 15 years on it after they retire working. Now, some people are going to live 25 years. Some people are only going to live 5 years. But the pension fund manager, just like an insurance manager, life insurance manager, an actuary, calculates all the numbers and all the probabilities and all this stuff, and so that the pension fund has enough money that everybody gets paid for the rest of their lives. They get their pension till the day they die. And this is how we used to do it in America. This is how there are still, you know, millions of employees, millions of people, millions of producers in America who get pensions. But big corporations in particular, General Motors, for example, IBM, AT&T, ExxonMobil, Bank of America, Pfizer, they have been pushing to do away with pensions and replace them with what are called defined contribution plans. A defined contribution plan like a 401k, basically a savings account. So if you put $200,000 into your 401k when you retire, you have $200,000, you know, plus whatever interest it's earned. And if you invested poorly, you might end up with $50,000 if the stock market tanks. So remember, pension, defined benefit. The amount of the benefit you're going to get forever is defined. You're going to get that till the day you die. 401k, defined contribution. You're going to define what you put in, and what you get out is whatever you get out. Okay, now here's the deal. This is the expose from today's Wall Street Journal. By Ellen Schultz and Theo Francis. It's brilliant. Brilliant reporting in today's Wall Street Journal. To help explain its deep slump, they write, General Motors Corp. often cites legacy costs, including pensions, for its giant U.S. workforce. For example, in its latest annual report, GM wrote, "Our extensive pension and post-employment obligations to retirees are a competitive disadvantage for us." Early this year, GM announced it was ending pensions for 42,000 workers. But, they write in today's Wall Street Journal, there's a twist to the automaker's pension situation. The pension plans for its rank-and-file U.S. workers are overstuffed with cash, containing about $9 billion more than is needed to meet their obligations for years to come. Go say what? You mean the pension plan isn't a problem? Well, they continue. Another of GM's pension programs, however, saddles the company with a liability of $1.4 billion. Now, what would this pension program be that's $1.4 billion in the hole? That's a $1.4 billion liability rather than a $9 billion net asset? These, write Schultz and Francis, these pensions are for its executives. This is the pension squeeze companies aren't talking about. Even as many companies reduce, freeze, or eliminate pensions for their workers, complaining of the costs, their executives are building up ever bigger pensions, causing the company's financial obligations for them to balloon. But companies disclose little about any of this. A Wall Street Journal analysis of corporate filings reveals that executive benefits are playing a large and hidden role in the declining health of America's pensions. Among the findings, they say, boosted by surging pay and rich formulas, executive pension obligations exceeded $1 billion at some individual companies. Besides General Motors, they include General Electric, $3.5 billion liability. That's for the executives. AT&T, $1.8 billion for the executives. ExxonMobil and International Business Machines Corp., $1.3 billion each. Bank of America and Pfizer, $1.1 billion each. They go on to point out that the executives typically get about 60% of their annual salary and bonus in their compensation. So if they're getting $10, $20 million a year, their pension, until the day they die, say if they're getting $10 million a year, it would be $6 million a year. On the other hand, the average worker, typically around 33% of their work, of their salary. 16 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, Ghost Chickens in the Sky. That's the song. Welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. This is mind-boggling. This is grotesque. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. They tell us this is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. The Wall Street Journal, you know, talking to the investor class about how their investments are being handled, and it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't add up here. They talk about David Dorman. He was the chief executive at AT&T Corporation from 2002 until its merger with SBC in November. Okay, so that's 5 years. This guy was the CEO. His total of 5 years at AT&T earned him a yearly pension of $2.1 million, 60% of his annual salary and bonus in his final 3 years. In other words, this guy is going to get, David Dorman is going to get $2.1 million a year for the rest of his life, no matter how long he lives. Then they contrast that with a bookkeeper at AT&T, a guy by the name of Ralph Collodi. He worked for the company for 33 years, not the 5 years that Dorman did. Dorman, who's the executive who's retiring with $2.1 million a year for the rest of his life. Instead, this guy worked for 33 years for AT&T. His pension, $28,800. 33% of his final pay versus the CEO who's getting 60% of his final pay. They add Mr. Collodi's pension was held down by a change AT&T made in 1998 in the formula used to calculate pensions. The switch had the effect of freezing pension growth for older workers like him. Amazing. And then they just go through some of the stories of some of these guys. This is incredible. Henry McKinnell. He's the CEO of Pfizer, chairman and CEO of Pfizer. They say he does the best of all. They're going to replace his $6.5 million a year salary when he retires with a $6.5 million a year pension for every year that he lives until the day he dies. They note Pfizer's promise to pay Mr. McKinnell $6.5 million a year for life in retirement equals an $83 million liability for Pfizer today, according to federal filings by the drug maker. Pfizer defends Mr. McKinnell's pension as fair. Well, United Health Group, I mean, they have a little bit of a problem over there. William McGuire, he's their CEO. This is the second largest health insurance company in the United States, the largest insurer under Medicare Part D. This is the company that made out like a bandit. Not literally, but, you know, made out very well as a result of Billy Towson, who now works for Pharma, the lobbying company for the pharmaceutical industry. This is the company that made out very, very well from Medicare, you know, putting in this drug benefit that's administered by insurance companies. This is one of the insurance companies, United Health Group. Their CEO, William McGuire, he's going to get a $5.1 million annual pension after he retires, plus $6.4 million when he retires. So he walks out the door with $6.4 million, plus he gets $5.1 million a year after retirement. Now, that's actually less as a percentage of his pay than a lot of these other CEOs are getting. Well, why did this guy get screwed? Why is he getting, you know, less as a percentage of his pay? He's getting $5.1 million a year every year after he retires until the day he dies. Well, because his pay last year was $1.6 billion. That's $1,600 million. His pay last year. So, you know, they just couldn't come up with enough money to match that with a pension. You can't give a guy, 100%, 50%. You can't give him an $800 million a year pension. It just wouldn't look right. They note in the Wall Street Journal today, even as executives' pensions grow, many companies are curtailing those for the rank and file. In one move, hundreds of employers, including Boeing Company, Xerox Corp, Electronic Data Systems Corp, have switched to pension formulas known as cash balance plans. One effect is to slow the growth of older workers' pensions or to halt it altogether. That's what happened to Mr. Colati at AT&T. Other companies, including Verizon Communications, Inc., Unisys Corp., and Sears Holding Corp., are freezing their pension plans for some workers. Some employers have added pensions for executives at about the same time as they've limited those for others. They point out, for example, at Allied Waste Industries, they froze their pensions for certain salaried workers in 1999, but 4 years later they adopted a pension plan for 10 of their top executives. So you're at the top of the food chain, you're doing very well, thank you very much. If you're anywhere else in the food chain, in the middle or the bottom, you'd be toast. At Nordstrom's, the nearly 30,000 ordinary employees don't get pensions, but 45 executives do. Another retailer, Dillard's Inc., also provides pensions only to certain officers. It just goes on and on and on. When General Motors cites retiree costs, the giant automaker has a point it owes. I'll continue with this when we come back from the break. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Great to meet you. Hope you get my name. Oh, yeah. But what busted you with the nature of my name? Oh, yeah. Get down here.
And welcome back. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. This article in the Wall Street Journal today, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is, Warren Buffett said it best back 4 or 5 years ago. Warren Buffett, the second richest man in America. He said, yes, indeed, there is a class war, and my class is winning. Even if it's, if a company's a liability, this is in the Wall Street Journal, even if a company's liability for executive pensions totals hundreds of millions of dollars, its employees and shareholders may never know. Companies don't have to report this obligation separately in federal financial filings. That's why this is a breaking news story in the financial world. That's why it's on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. That you've got, like Aflac, for example, 58% of their total pension liability is their senior executives. And we're talking big bucks here. They, for example, they you know, not that there's a shortage of examples, but they say Lucian Technologies, Inc. has pointed to retiree benefits as a burden and has cut benefits in a number of ways. For instance, for various retirees in recent years, Lucian has used a less generous pension formula, eliminated dental and spousal medical coverage and death benefits. They've raised retiree health insurance premiums. In a recent filing, the Murray Hill, New Jersey telecom equipment company, this is Lucian Technologies, said, quote, Lucian's pensions and post-retirement benefits plans are large but also costly, end quote. Yet the pension plans for regular Lucian employees, employees and retirees, who number about 230,000, are overfunded. In fact, they're so full of cash that the investment return on their assets not only erases the pension plan's expense, it adds to earnings. In the fiscal year ended last September 30th, these pension plan assets pumped $973 million into Lucian's bottom line, accounting for about 82% of the company's profits. They would have pumped in still more, except for the unfunded pension plan for Lucian's highest paid people, which had a liability of approximately $422 million last year. This is for everybody at Lucian who earns more than $210,000 a year. You get this? The average employees are paying into their pension funds, and those pension funds have so much cash in them that last year the surplus cash that spilled over back into the company was $973 million, which the company took as profit. Meanwhile, they shift $422 million to their senior executives and do it kind of on the sly. The Wall Street Journal notes, when General Motors cites retiree costs, the giant automaker has a point. It owed nearly 700,000 U.S. workers and retirees pensions that totaled $87.8 billion at the end of last year. So, you know, just follow the numbers here for a minute. About 750,000 workers, and they're owed $87 billion. That's a lot of money. But $95.3 billion has already been set aside to pay those benefits when due, write Schultz and Francis in today's Wall Street Journal. In other words, GM has more money in the pension fund than they're ever going to have to pay out. In fact, they go on to say all of those assets are earning investment returns which offset the pension's expense. In other words, these pensions are operating at a profit. GM lost $10.6 billion in 2005, but deep as its losses have been, they would have been far worse without the more than $10 billion per year in investment income that the GM pension plan for the rank and file generates. But the pension plan for GM executives is another matter. Unfunded to the tune of $1.4 billion, it detracts from GM's bottom line each year. Just how much is a mystery? Because GM doesn't break out the figure. By the way, earlier this year, GM announced it would freeze the pensions of its 42,000 salaried workers starting next January. This is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. And then there's another piece by Theo Francis and Ellen Schultz. Besides pensions, most large companies owe their executives another retirement debt, deferred compensation. In other words, pay that you get after you've quit working there. Not pensions, not retirement pay, pay. It's like what Dick Cheney is making right now from Halliburton. They're called deferred comp plans. General Electric's deferred comp plan right now, deferred compensation, in other words, pay that they're going to pay to executives who no longer work there that isn't part of their pensions or retirement, $2.4 billion. It's total unfunded liabilities for executives, just for the fat cats. Deferred comp plus pensions equals more than 15% as much as its total retirement liability for more than 500,000 workers and retirees. Countrywide Financial Corp's executive retirement liability, pensions plus deferred comp, at the end of last year stood at $340 million. That's to a handful of senior executives. How much do they owe their 25,900 and ordinary workers and retirees? I say ordinary because that's the phrase they used in the Wall Street Journal article here. $373 million, about the same. Comcast, executive retirement liability, $469 million. Keep in mind, this isn't the pension. The pensions of all their normal employees, only $194 million. Incredible. You can check it. It's right there on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. It's like, you know, hey, you guys want class war? We'll give you class war. And by the way, we're going to kick your butts. Yeah, they're doing it. And then you go to USA Today, their Moneyline column. A widely watched gauge of economic activity slipped in May, the conference board said Thursday, suggesting that the nation's economy is likely to cool in the coming months, also indicating that the economy is losing steam. The Labor Department reported Thursday that the number of Americans filing claims for unemployment benefits climbed by the largest amount in 5 weeks. And what does this mean? Slower growth. In this report, okay, the conference board says its index of leading economic indicators fell 0.6% after it declined 0.1% in April. Okay. And then on the next story down, or actually three stories down, mortgage rates climb on Fed rate fears. Mortgage rates rose this week with 30-year fixed mortgages climbing to the highest level in more than 4 years on investor fears about inflation. Freddie Mac, the mortgage company, reported Thursday that rates on 30-year fixed-rate mortgages rose to a nationwide average of 6.71%. Highest 30-year fixed rate since 2002. What this says to me is that we are going back to stagflation. Those of you who are old enough to remember the years of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan and Bush Sr. will remember stagflation. Particularly, Carter was particularly hard hit by it, President Jimmy Carter. And it was really the result, the consequence, of Richard Nixon's policies. What Nixon did is he borrowed a whole pile of money, and he spent it on something that did not produce a return on investment. That was the war in Vietnam. So you borrow $1 billion, and then you spend that $1 billion on a war. Well, that, you know, if some of that expense actually stimulates the U.S. economy, you know, building bullets, building bombers, making armor, that kind of thing, sort of stimulates the economy, but not over the long term. If, on the other hand, he had done what Franklin Roosevelt did, borrow $1 billion and build roads and bridges and railroads and sewage disposal plants and water treatment plants, and the infrastructure for business and for residential, you know, if extending electricity and telephone service out to people's homes in rural areas, if he had put that money, if Nixon had put that money instead of into the Vietnam War, if he had instead put that money into infrastructure, into building our schools, into building our colleges, into giving kids educations, giving kids scholarships to college, if he had done that instead, the next 10, 20, 30 years, you would see steady growth of the economy. But instead what happened was, A, because he spent that money on, you know, you spend the money on a bomb, and when that bomb goes off, it's gone. The money's gone. It's not coming back. A bomb is not going to make you money the way a bridge will. So number one, he spent the money on disposable products, shall we say. And number two, having spent that money on these disposable products, because he had borrowed that money, there was inflation to account. You know, inflation came into this thing, and so you get this problem of this mixture of inflation and an economy that's not growing, that's stagnating, because we've been putting all of our government stimulus, you know, the stuff that just, you know, just is shot in there just to keep the economy going a little bit. That stimulation has all been based on, A, on borrowed money, which causes the value of money, you know, the value of the currency to go down, so it's, you have inflation. And it's being spent on war material, which doesn't produce any return on investment. The result is what's called stagflation. And it took about 15 years for the United States economy, through the Carter years and through the Reagan years and through the Bush years, the first Bush, it took about 15 years for the stagflation to wring out of the economy, for us to recover from the insanity of the Vietnam War. And we're doing it again. And I predict that we are entering a period. I'll tell you, 5 years from now, we'll be looking back and going, oh, that's when the stagflation began. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. And boy, are they out there flying around in every which way. By the way, thanks so much this week to my producer, David Poole. Happy birthday, David. To Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, and Dan Jacobs at Air America. To Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org. To Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room. And Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. And to Tim MacArthur at Air America, who's been sharing board op responsibilities with Alex for low these many weeks, and I think taking over much of it. So all of you doing a marvelous job, and very pleased to have you all participating with me in this. Back to economics. Having laid out what's happening with the U.S. economy, now look at how it's how this is playing out around the world. I want to compare three countries in the 6 minutes or so we have before the end of the show. And just give you a quick snapshot of three countries and what's going on. India, Germany, and Iran. And how this is playing out. In Germany, Germany has been, in a very real way, buying into what the Europeans refer to as the liberal economic model. Here in the United States, we would call that the conservative economic model, which confuses people in the United States to no end. Economic liberalism means liberal for the corporations in Europe. And Germany has been buying into this. They've been reducing the power of labor unions. They've been cutting back on laws about how many, you know, what the workplace protections, essentially. There's a whole bunch of laws in Germany that make it very difficult to fire people once they've been working for a number of years and established they're a decent employee. If somebody gets pregnant, if somebody is injured, there's all kinds of workplace protections. Now, if you get a good, solid job in Germany, it traditionally had been thought of as, hey, you had your future. And they built a tremendously strong middle class. Germany, Japan, and the United States until 1981, when Ronald Reagan began the war on America's middle class, had the three strongest middle classes in the world. But Germany has been drinking the Kool-Aid. They've been drinking the Kool-Aid that Margaret Thatcher was force-feeding to England, and Ronald Reagan started pouring down the throats of Americans. And so here, this from, these are all from the Wall Street Journal, all three of these stories. This by Marcus Walker. Germany plans to unveil a deep cut to its corporate tax rate as early as next week in an effort to make the country more attractive for investors, buckling to a European Union trend that Berlin had previously characterized as unfair tax competition. This is the consequence, in large part, of Germany participating with the Economic Union, or the European Union, the EU, and the EU bringing in all these former Soviet countries, bringing them in and saying, okay, you can transport anything across borders. There's no more tariffs. We won't have tariffs anymore to protect individual economies. Can't do that. And if you can't protect individual economies with tariffs, you can't balance, level the playing field, then whoever has the lowest corporate tax, all the corporations are going to move there. And Germany's corporate tax has been 38.9%. Now, keep in mind, in the United States, although our nominal corporate tax is 39.3%, back in the 1950s, corporations were paying just a little less than half of the total load for the cost of maintaining our civil society. Now they're paying less than 10%. in the United States. Well, in Germany right now, it's 38.9%, but they're competing with now with Slovakia, where it's 19%, or Hungary, where it's 16%. And because they don't have tariffs any longer to protect themselves from that competition, German companies are just saying, hey, we're out of here. We're going to shut this factory down, and we're going to move our operations to Hungary because the labor is cheaper there and the taxes are lower there. And over the short term, Hungary will see a boom. But over the long term, it's going to level off, and they're going to have the exact same experience that England has had and that the United States has had and that other countries that have drank this Kool-Aid have had, and that is meltdown, the end of the middle class. But as Marcus Walker writes in the Wall Street Journal, the government believes it is the nominal corporate tax rate that turns potential investors away from Germany and toward low tax havens such as Ireland and Slovakia, which have become magnets for foreign investment in recent years. So you got that. Now, here's what's happening in India, on the other hand. India's prime minister said his government is going to spend $10.9 billion over the next 5 years on urban infrastructure. Additional resources will come from state and municipal bodies. They're raising taxes and spending. Why? He says urban areas must be seen as engines of growth, as places where the economies of scale and scope, and hence as hubs of economic activity. He made the remarks at the inauguration of Mumbai Metro, a planned 90-mile network of elevated and underground rail routes. While America's infrastructure is crumbling and Germany's going to have to start defunding theirs, India's building theirs like crazy. And then in Iran, what accounts for the popularity of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad? Well, in recent weeks, he's proposed a $4 billion national school renovation program. He raised salaries for workers in Iran's vast government-controlled industrial sector and raised the minimum wage for everybody else. He doubled government grants for newlyweds and forced banks to lower interest rates by several percentage points. His anti-elite message in defiance of the West is causing his popularity to soar. His policies have helped him wield more influence than any thought possible for an Iranian president. So, what do you do? Well, you figure out what's going on here. Following the policies of Franklin Roosevelt, actually build a nation and build popularity for a leader. Following the policies of Bush and Thatcher, drive a nation into destruction. Thanks for being with us this week, my friends. Remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.